Hey guys, welcome to the next episode of Drugs and Stuff. Today, Dave Crossland and I are speaking with Sean Bellin. We're going to discuss mental health, and we thought it would be a good idea to issue a trigger warning with this, because there is going to be some talk of depression and suicide. Before we get started with this, we are going to play this this talk that Sean had given, and then from there, we're going to go straight into the interview. All right, guys, here we go.
All right, you probably guessed. I work out. Hopefully, you think that. It was really cool to have the opportunity to be a professional lifter. That's actually a thing. I was sponsored by a supplement company, and I was paid to lift weights. Go to demos, different events all over the country, and give you a lot of free stuff. Got a column in a magazine, met all these different famous people. It was awesome. This guy that I met, and it was weird how fate brought us together. His name is Wes, total fitness guru. Professionally, this is a guy that I wanted to be. He had it all together. I mean, he was just, everybody came to him when it came to different training philosophies, anything cutting edge. This guy was on it. Author. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I want to write books. So I got to hang out with him. We lived in the same town. I was probably like this pesky little brother. Mind you, Wes looks a lot like me, a little taller, a little bigger, more ink, goatee, shaved head. I hung out with him every Thursday. We'd crush a pizza, talk about different things. And at first it was just talking about lifting, kind of professional things. He was trying to help me grow, and I loved that. I mean, he was just kind of paying it forward. But what I really remember about Wes sharing with me, we're sitting there eating, as we talk about philosophy, he got me into the Stoics. I was just like, this is awesome. I saw a side to him that I didn't expect, and it resonated with me more than the actual lifting. One of the things about him that I appreciated so much was just his love for people, for things that were alive, and his cliche thing that I would courageously mock him for would be, he would remind me, Sean, all sentient beings deserve to be alive and to be loved. And that just stuck with me. So this morning goes, jumping on my computer, check some client stuff, get my email. I see this email from Wes, and I'm reading it. It's a little confusing. And then I'm like, what is this? Down at the bottom it says, and make sure somebody put Sissy to sleep. It's one of his cats, his lover of life. He had all these feral cats. That's odd. So I try to call him, because I'm like, what is this? This is really weird. A little disturbed. Goes right to voicemail. I get a number that calls me. I don't recognize it, but I'm like, okay. It's his sister. She wants to tell me, hey, have you heard? And I'm like, what? It's so terrible. And I'm like, okay. Wes is gone. Where'd he go? No, you don't understand, Sean. Last night, he sat down and he put a shotgun in his mouth and he took his life. I'm like, no, sorry, no. Heroes don't do that. This is my Yoda. No, you're wrong. It can't be right. She asks me to come to his house. Like, all right, I'm driving, shooken up, confused. I'm wondering where this is leading. Get to his house, pull up, as always, I just walk in. As soon as I walk in, I'm just like hit right in the face with this pungent smell. And I'm like, ugh, this cleaner. That's not his house. His house smells like cats. And as I'm doing this, and I look up at the ceiling in his living room, and I see this big hole. I'm like, slowly things are just coming around me, and I'm not really hearing a whole lot. I don't think I felt a whole lot. It's what is going on. I start to crumple down on the floor against the wall by the door. I notice on the floor an assortment of bloody paw prints all over. I have so many tears flooding, trying to make sense of this. This is not right. Hero, big brother, he doesn't do that. No, he's got things figured out. This is not right. His mom comes to me. I'm not sure what she said. It was something about his orders for his books, something. They needed help on the computer. So I get up and I go to the desk and I sit in the very spot or not, several hours before he was sitting. I'm at the desk and I put them on the keyboard, and I can see blood, little pieces of Wes on the keyboard. And I just said, no, I gotta go. I went out the door and I jumped in my car and I just drove. I don't know where I was going. And honestly, it felt like 10 years. And I still look back and I just don't, I struggle. I was left with this really brutal lesson. Suicide doesn't care what your position is. It doesn't care about your power, your strength, or your status. Thank you.
Guys, welcome back to Drugs and Stuff with Dave Crossland. Today we have with us special guest powerlifter Sean Bellin. And Sean thought it would be a good idea if we issued a trigger warning for this episode, because we are going to be talking about mental health, and we know some of that stuff gets pretty dark. So just keep that in mind as we move forward. And we're also going to try to not make this like a depressing show at the same time. If you guys had tuned in just a few minutes ago, we had aired Sean's story. Sean, where did you tell that story? Because that was really well done, man. That was like something I would expect to see on like NPR. You know,
thank you.
It was very, very well done. Very, very entertaining at the same time. And it really, man, was intense.
I had an opportunity with this group that I had connected with and interviewed and discussed back and forth. So they invited me to go out to New York City. So it was awesome. Got to stay down in Times Square. That was so fun.
Nice.
But so we actually did training with a couple of these individuals that are sort of freelancers for this group called The Moth. And it's funny that you say that, yeah, because they do, these two particular trainers, they do a lot of the sort of consulting that NPR uses and several programs that they are brought in on.
Yeah, I'm familiar with The Moth Radio Hour. That's exactly what I was thinking. It's like The Moth storytelling. That's very exactly it, man. And the way that you told the story too, you didn't just tell the story itself. We got to know who you were in the process and a little bit of your background too, which is cool.
Well, and what they do in that kind of training is they really want to, because all of us could go on and on and maybe get lost in a lot of things retelling. So it was very specific of a segment of life. And it really was just sort of a little preface. Others just kind of jumped right in. Very intense going through that, especially kind of reliving some of those, you know, just, I just remember a lot of it coming back to me. And it was a very emotional time, but at the same time, very rewarding. I felt like I really did justice to sharing something that I know Wes, in retrospect, would have been like, yeah, you definitely need to use this to help others.
Right on. So to start us out, before we get into talking about mental health, tell me a little bit about your powerlifting.
I don't do a lot of it anymore, that's for sure. But I started when I was 11 lifting weights and just kind of gravitated towards strength. It just kind of spoke to me. Scott Stevenson can tell you that I'm a very terrible wannabe bodybuilder.
How does he know this? What's your relation to Scott?
I actually lived in Tucson when Scott was there for a few years. So I got familiar with him, and to see him training up close, and Dave Henry, and those guys are just unreal. Scott is probably one of the most cerebral, intense people I've ever seen, period, working out.
No kidding.
He's like really, he's really cool to watch. So, cool. And he loves dogs, so he's got to be a great person.
Yeah.
But so my powerlifting, as it got better and better, I started to get into, you know, just wanted to compete and lift, but everybody was like wearing gear, squat suits and knee wraps and stuff. And as I was, it just wasn't very appealing to me because I liked to work out. I didn't want the continuity and the flow. So I just started lifting against guys just with, you know, knee sleeves and a belt, do my thing. And I was beating them. So I got better and better, got invited to like go to the Olympia as a raw lifter. I don't know that the sponsor Inser was very aware of that. So they made an announcement that I lifted raw. Then I was asked not to go back to lift there anymore.
You're kidding me.
Yeah, it was more of a courtesy there, but they sent me a bunch of Inser gear. They're like, you know, if you come back, you know, would you wear this? But we want it to be a raw lifting experience for other opportunities. This is really all about Inser and the single ply lifters. So it was cool. So, you know, I set some records within the USPA IPL Federation, and, you know, most were passed. It was cool because as I started, you know, kind of being into the raw lifting, then it picked up more and more. And now it's amazing to see what some of these raw lifters will do, you know, even without knee wraps. These guys are just immense beasts with lifting, and the women as well. So it's been really cool. But since then, you know, I have a jacked up shoulder. I just had a total hip replacement just a year ago.
I saw the picture of that. Yeah.
Celebrating my birthday for my hip. So I actually started slowly getting back into just doing deadlift only.
Okay.
And had an opportunity to do a fundraiser for a family that lost their son to suicide, and pulled a 672 at the 242 weight class. So I'm also a lighter weight class than I was before.
Okay.
So I'll probably stay in the 220, 242 class. So yeah, it's been fun to kind of reignite and then use my lifting as a little bit more of a conversation piece, or these fundraisers are really cool. So yeah,
that's cool, man. I, you know, so when I had seen your video, you had posted that on social media, and I was very touched by it. I just woke up one morning and I remember distinctly sitting on the couch, you know, you're scrolling through Facebook, and you see, you know, something that just catches your eye, hit play. And I, you know, instantly was captivated by it. You know, I knew I wanted to have you on, but I thought to myself not to just bring you on as a one-on-one interview. Dave Crossland, you know, he does a lot of work with harm prevention. And Dave, you're somebody who's been a big proponent of mental health. You know, we've had a lot of conversations like regarding CBD and the popularity of it. That's the first thing I really noted from Dave, was he thought to, you know, he said, CBD, yeah, maybe this could be beneficial, but let's look at the root cause of why are people needing to take drugs like CBD in life. you know, why don't we fix those things? So I thought this would be a great opportunity to bring both of you guys together versus just have just you and I, you know, on so you could share your message. You had mentioned too, now in your story about Wes, you talked a lot about his own life, and his own struggles with depression. Had you mentioned too, that you've gone through your own issues, with mental health?
Yeah. Yeah. I think, especially at my age at 46 now, to have spent really 2/3 of my life not really realizing what was wrong with me. So I was diagnosed a couple of years ago with borderline personality disorder, which a lot of people don't know what that is, or on face value they hear it and think, oh my gosh, that's horrific.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up hearing from case managers, you know, from behavioral health, or when I was a wellness coordinator, they used to joke, and it was one of those things where when somebody was very difficult to deal with a patient, they would like go borderline, you know, and they would just, and I didn't know what they were talking about. So somebody explained, and the first time I heard about it was this case manager telling me that, oh yeah, that's like the worst diagnosis. They're like impossible to treat. And they're so hard to deal with. So then flash forward, I'm getting this diagnosis and I'm like, great, that's awesome. In some ways, it did explain some of my struggles going through with those things. You know, that's something that it would have been great to have been diagnosed with when I was 18.
Yeah.
And then work through some of the processes of dialectical behavior therapy and things. But it didn't work out that way. This is where I'm at now. So the great thing is to be able to share that and to go through. And then on top of it, PTSD, suicidal ideation, and depressive disorder. So people hear all that and they're like, wow, that's a lot.
Yeah.
And, like it is, I guess. But it's nice to, at times labels can be bad, but this at least has given me a chance to sort of troubleshoot with my own recovery on my end of it for my wellness. And then of course, the doctors that I work with as well to be more effective. And, I probably over the last 8-10 months, I felt the best I've ever felt in my life.
That's awesome, man. That's awesome. And I do think, yeah, it does make sense. I've actually had been in a relationship with a girl that had been borderline personality, and we didn't know it when I first started seeing her. We eventually found out, right. We didn't find out because things were going so good. I am familiar with DBT therapy. From what I understand, that is that's the key. You know, there's no drug that you can take for something like borderline. It's something that you do need to be able to actually work on. So I think that's a good point too. It's not just something that you're just going to medicate away. You know, what do you guys think overall about the use of medications, you know, in the world right now?
Dave? Before we move on, Sean, can you explain in very layman terms what that is? Because I know that's not a phrase that's overly common in the UK.
Borderline or DBT?
Both.
Okay. Borderline personality disorder really is, it's not so much a mental illness as it's a trauma-based experience, usually very early on in life, and your brain sort of gets rewired a little bit because of that. And if not dealt with, you know, you again are just establishing more and more habits. It's very emotional and reactionary. We make jokes about it.
So that could manifest as almost like a destructive personality trait. Because you've experienced, for argument's sake, abusive parents, you then create a mindset of low worth, whatever it is, and then you develop destructive personality traits where you will purposely sabotage yourself moving forward from that point because that trauma has set you to believe that going forward.
Yeah, that's putting it lightly, but we are all about crash and burn. Self-inflicted crash and burn, big time. And again, that you know, the defensiveness. You have a heightened state, fight or flight mode, which I never realized this, but all of these years of training, my body hurt. And actually, you know, which isn't to say anything, but the, like, I was some great trainee, but I hurt more than others because of the high amped up levels of cortisol having this disorder, which I'm like, well, that sucked. Like, got to fix this, and what could I have done? You know, so I go off to comparing it to fixing lifting, but yeah. So you stay amped up a lot, and it is hard because you, in some ways, are very good at reading the room, but then you apply not a paranoia, but you just overthink and then worry and react, and it can be so problematic. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. And if you go to Psychology Today or some of the different sites, they have a tests that you can take, and then present that with a practitioner, a psychiatrist, and kind of go forward with that. But there are, you know, if you're like five of the components, that's something to investigate with yourself. Everybody's going to be able to pull a few things out and be like, oh yeah, I've got this, I've got that, I've got three of them. I had nine.
Oh wow.
So I sort of passed or failed, depending on how you look at it. And I remember talking to one of my friends who's a chaplain for the VA, and he's like, yeah, I always thought you had that. And I got really mad and I yelled at him. I was like, why didn't you tell? And he's like, well, look how you're reacting right now. And I'm like, oh, yeah. So unfortunately, a lot of that was hard for me. And having that mindset, you can imagine somebody with that type of mindset, how they struggle with social media, bodybuilding boards, all the forums and stuff. I would be so confused by people. It was just a bad environment for me. And all it did was further my self-worth, my shame about myself, more suicidal ideation, trying to take my life years back as a result. A lot of the borderline has the highest rate for suicide. So it's unfortunate. There's a lot of things that get missed because it's not as simple as just taking a medication. I can take gabapentin to control what they call borderline rage. Luckily for me, it doesn't manifest outwards. I internalize it to the point that I get a really, really bad headache and I pass out.
Wow.
Luckily, but I never knew that's what it was. They diagnosed me early on in my life and said I had some type of seizure disorder. And all the meds they tried to put me on to fix that, it just made everything worse. So, yeah. Anyway, yeah. Borderline is fascinating. There really is a lot to it. I just encourage everyone to take their time. If somebody in their life, don't pigeonhole them based on what they've read on an article and be like, oh, that's you, you must be that. And don't get caught up in the words. Borderline is often associated with saying you are manipulative. Well, that's not necessarily a bad word. You have to define it in the context of what a psychologist is discussing with that. So it is definitely a topic that in itself you could go on and on all day to discuss. It's pretty cool, but I'm finding it very interesting. I wish I didn't have it, though. I wish I was just, as I call, the normals.
Sure.
You guys.
Who is normal?
Dave, your connection's really been bad. It's hard to even see the video.
I am just about to change it now.
Okay.
So,
is he stealing Wi-Fi from his neighbor?
I think so. I think he's going to...
Quit your bitching.
He's going to connect to his neighbor's Wi-Fi. He's got a cord running through the window. We'll see what happens. He's totally frozen now. Well, while he's frozen, yeah, I'll tell you, man. I mean, just from my own personal experience, it was tough. It was tough in my life to deal someone that you know, that had that. And unfortunately, what I've seen in a couple people, hey, Dave cleared up. A couple people that
is that any better?
That is better. A couple of people that I've seen that I know have had it, they haven't sought help. You know, they haven't continued to seek help. And that's, I think, what the issue is. And I think that the bigger issue, you know, and I think the reason that it's so important that we share your message of mental health here on the show is because I think, you know, as bodybuilders, as powerlifters, as people in the strength and fitness worlds, we, as you were for a long, long time, we don't want to admit that we have any kind of weaknesses, and we don't want to look at the potential that maybe there is some type of a help that we could use. And that's really what your message is here, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. The fact that we can recognize that there are some things that, you know, as they use the word normal, but everybody struggles, and we have mental health, we have mental illness, and those are terms that can be sort of the same, but I have a mental health, but I also have mental illness. You may just have mental health, but we are still recognize we don't want to take away from what you struggle and you go through. We also don't want to, because of the normals, you're saying, you know, hey, just go see a movie or just smile.
Yeah.
Well, somebody with a mental illness, we don't want to marginalize that either. So we definitely want to make a distinction, but we're discussing that whole idea though. But within all that, there really can be hope and recovery, and it's individual for each person, but it's also a long haul. It's not going to be something that's quick and gets fixed. And as much as I'm a pro-medication person, I know that was the discussion where we wanted to go to, it's not as simple as that.
Yeah.
It just isn't. Regardless of the people that I go to, you know, I'm a volunteer and I go to a NAMI peer group, people will talk about their medications that they take, but I mean, there's still, you've got to, you know, if you're taking a medication, you should see a psychiatrist, not a general practitioner. They're just not qualified, yeah, well-meaning or not. You should definitely be in some type of group if possible. And then you should start setting up an actual action plan for yourself on a daily basis. Mm. We will be so meticulous in figuring out contest prep.
Right.
But we won't do it for what's going on in here. That is just sort of ignored. And we can't do that. And especially the people that struggle with mental illness, I think it's exciting because we can really strategize and tackle this. And for a lot of people, it's just admitting and hearing from somebody else, oh, wow, this guy was a world record holder. Mm. He worked for magazines. He's done some of these different things, and here he's talking about it. I thought one of the best things that I heard was Kevin Love for the Cleveland Cavaliers being very open, talking about his clinical depression.
Mm.
To me, that was encouraging. I'm like, oh, this is great. And it's not saying, oh, I was sad I didn't get a movie role.
Yeah.
That stuff annoys me. I don't want to hear a star just trying to trend because mental health topics are popular. But that was really great to hear an actual person just being human and exposing, being vulnerable. And that was the whole point of the talk that we did. It's about just being vulnerable and letting each person kind of pull from that what they need and what they can help experientially for themselves. But
yeah.
I think one of the dangers with medication is that people stop looking for the solution.
Yes, yes.
Medication is a useful tool to lower symptoms, to give you the breathing space you need to put processes and strategize and plans in place to cope. But ultimately, you need to learn to cope.
Absolutely.
And one of the generational problems, and I presume it's as bad over there as over here, we're very similar age, Sean, so I'm... Even though I may look 10 years older than you, I'm only 2 years older than you. that's drugs. What can I say? But we have a problem where generations growing up now are overly protected and as a result don't develop coping strategies. You know, though bullying is an awful thing, we all went through it at some point, at some stage in school.
Yeah.
But what that taught us was how to cope with those situations.
True, yeah.
Because children are so protected to a large extent now, they don't learn coping mechanisms. So when they get to adult life and those protective barriers are removed, they struggle to cope with things that a generation before was just part of the hard knocks of life and learning to cope. And so... though medication can be very, very useful and can be a game changer for some people from taking them away from the edge, it isn't the cure. The cure is reprogramming and learning to cope with whatever you have difficulties with. But spinning this on the head, do you think we'd be sat here now talking with that rack of medals at the back of you if you didn't have the mental health issues you have?
Hmm.
What medals? Oh, those.
Those conveniently placed there.
it was my wife's idea.
I take the piss, but I know for a fact, if I was wired normally, I wouldn't have done what I did.
Yeah. I would say, to go backtracking a little bit, easily for me, if somebody said really, really quick, what is borderline personality disorder to you? And I would say all or nothing. And I applied that meticulousness when I trained, when I was at my peak, when I was training to go after the all-time squat record, regardless of federation, all that. Everything was all. Absolutely. No stone unturned. Everything, it had to be. And if it was just off a little bit, I was so irate. It's nothing off. Could get in my way of that. It had to be that way. There was no discussion. This, unfortunately, that's not how lives work, integrating with others or having a 12-year-old. You know, that is hard for me to adjust to that. That is a regular struggle. So what I've come to terms with, and I this great individual that I talked to with him, and the whole idea of what I dealt with having my hip replacement, and I thought I was just being hard on myself, and he was like, this has been you for how long? And your hip replacement is sort of that finality on that chapter of your life. You don't get to be that anymore. Of course, this is traumatic for you. And so I thought about it. And he said, you know, what is wrong with you being that dedicated and that, you know, can you see the benefit of that? And I was just like, so in some ways I look at that, or the hypervigilance and being very protective of others. You know, I see there being sort of a benefit to that. But would I have achieved what I did without that? I don't think so, because the original reason for me to start lifting to begin with was coping with a very, very abusive home. And that was my goal. I was going to get strong, and I was going to stop my stepdad. Yeah. And I went after it, and I got stronger. And all of a sudden, I found that lifting was this amazing therapy. Again, for everybody, you know, it really can be. I know, you know, Dave Tate on Elite FTS, and they talked about, well, you know, lifting isn't therapy. And they had some good points that they made. But for me, it was an escape. I could just go somewhere else and be there. The endorphins, all these other things that are going on. But yeah, no question, I would not have achieved what I did as a lifter had I not gone through that trauma. Whether I realized it or not, I was able to use that.
How have you coped with the adjustment of not being that athlete anymore?
Very, very depressing. I was actually hospitalized not that long ago because I was at a point where things were just crumbling around me. I was working in a call center. I just was like, this is not, you know, I go from 4 years getting ready to break this all-time squat record that Stan Efferding set, and all of a sudden, you know, I get hurt, life spirals down. Now you have a hip that needs to get replaced. Mm. And by the way, you have spinal stenosis. Your other hip needs to get replaced in a couple of years too. I was just like, what am I now?
Yeah, you lose your identity, don't you? Completely lose your identity.
Yes. As much as I caution people that I work with and coach and share with to stay as balanced as they can, I felt like a fraud because, yeah, I was just like, that's me. Coaching is great and I love it. It's really empowering, but what am I now? So the same thing that anybody with it, and that's a mental health struggle in itself. You know, all of us, athletes that retire or a career change or anything, you know, relational, what am I now? And that was hard. I tanked for about a year and a half. That was just, that was hard. I can't say I fought the good fight because I was just really down. But I look back at it, I'm like, that's normal. That actually seems pretty normal to be down like that. That's all right.
It's common with a lot of pro-end athletes when they retire, if they don't get involved, because a lot will get involved with coaching or will get involved with media outlet type stuff. If they don't, they feel they lose relevance because you've invested so much of your time, so much of your energy. and you really have failed to focus on the rest of you. Yeah. And I know now, even now, I can quite happily not train. And it's like, well, how can you go from where you were to actually getting stressed if you were 5 minutes late to eat a meal to now not bothering eating all day and not bothering training? And the simple answer is because, and you'll appreciate this, what's the point? Because it's half what it used to be.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's half-assed.
Yeah.
I can never repeat what I did. I can never train at that intensity again. And yeah. So everything else just feels false.
Yeah.
It feels fake. Feels like you're playing at it.
Yeah.
If you're not passed out in a corner with blood streaming out your nostrils and your ear holes or puking in a bucket every time you train, then what's the point of training?
Right.
And that is the point you get to. If you are not completely annihilating yourself in that gym, then I'm not training. So what's the point in bothering? And then you start that downward spiral because you don't like how you look, you don't like how you feel, but everything you attempt to do is second or third rate because you just cannot perform at that level anymore for yeah. whatever the restriction would be, maybe physical, with needs a combination of physical and chemical, because I can't perform because I can't take drugs anymore. So though I can train hard, I can never train at the intensity and level that drugs allow me to train at. You know, it'd be like driving a 300-mile-an-hour supercar. Anything under 100 mile an hour after that would just seem like standing still.
I think the scary part about that takes
some getting your head around.
Well, I think the scary part of that is even trying to. So do we endorse that as it's just a season and then it's gone and then what? Or do we caution people early on where they are to be like, this isn't necessarily sustainable? And I've said it more and more, you're only one major injury away from all this that you're investing in to be totally changed.
Well, the other problem as well is if that you don't have that intensity, you won't succeed.
Sure.
In these sports. You have to, in a degree, go into the realms of mental health illness to be mentally ill in order to be the top of the game. Because a balanced individual wouldn't sacrifice what needs to be sacrificed to be number one. And yeah. There's no avoiding that. But
it makes me feel bad.
Recognizing those problems means you can build in defense strategies and support networks to help you when it eventually comes.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm good friends with Andy Bolton, and I know Andy's mentally gone through hell with his kidney problems because he's just not been well enough to even lift a weight. And for about the 10th time now, he's back starting lifting 60 kilos. You know, this is the man that first lifted 1,000 pounds and has done it probably more yeah. times than anyone else. And that, I think, is a big problem. But I think it goes down the line as well, and this is what I see mental health in bodybuilders and to a degree powerlifters, that they focus so much on that immediate goal, they start to sacrifice the quality of other aspects of the life. And then when that immediate goal moves, so post-comp would be the first thing with bodybuilders, same again with post-powerlifters or post-injury, whatever it be, they then struggle to engage with who they really are anymore.
Yeah.
And it is important to just take some time out and try and be yourself, or at least have another hobby in the background. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the one thing Aaron Hudson, we were talking to Aaron Hudson a couple of weeks ago. He's getting into politics, a UK bodybuilder. But it's one thing he's always been very, very good at, having his other interests in his life and balance. He's never been willing to sacrifice and go that all for one. I don't get me wrong, he's dedicated when he commits to a show. But he always has his business. He always has his family. He always has, obviously, politics is an interest to him as well. And you see, when you start speaking to pro-end athletes, and you will have spoke to a lot of pro-end athletes within the powerlifting sport, you will have met them, you will have seen them, you'll realize how actual, beyond that facade, empty their lives are if it wasn't for the sport that they do. And I see that more and more in amateur level now than I've seen in the past.
Sure, I do too, absolutely.
The big driver there is social media, without doubt, because it presents this false ideal of what, and it allows people to prevent a false idea as well. It makes it easier to hide. It can be traumatic, and like you said, it can be a very difficult world to live in, particularly with trolls and haters and all that sort of crap. But it also allows people who are ill to present a false life that they then actually start to believe themselves.
Sure, because they can convince other people quite easily, you know, and then they've got people to back them up. Yeah. So, you know, here's a thought then, guys, you know, because this is something I could really relate to. I'm in recovery for drugs. You know, I work a 12-step program. And,
Cool. Congratulations.
Thank you. You know, before that, you know, I had a lot of issues with mental health, as you can imagine. You know, I didn't get into recovery because life was going so awesome. It got pretty bad. It got pretty bad, you know. But before I got into recovery, one of the things I did try to do was get into weightlifting and get into bodybuilding and try to make that my identity. And I basically lifted weights the same way that I would abuse drugs. And it became a very unhealthy thing. And eventually I got injured. We recently did another episode of a program for advices with Nate Spear, who has 7 years clean now. He's about to compete at North Americans. He didn't even start getting into serious bodybuilding until he had 3 years clean. Now, you know, when I got into recovery, I stopped lifting for a little while because I was afraid to kind of go down that path again. Can you guys talk about trying to find that balance? Like, what is it going to take if you are somebody, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of people out there that are in bodybuilding, that are in powerlifting, that can identify with what we're talking about here, about being extreme. I mean, how do you strike that balance of still being good at what you do and still trying to maintain, you know, the rest of your life and not being, you know, just a bodybuilder, just a power lifter.
So,
I would say it was really circumstantial with the whole hip replacement deal, because I didn't really have a choice. You know, on top of my mental illness and knowing my diagnosis and going through that. So it actually forced me to literally slow down to the point where, you know, I'm hobbling on crutches. And as you can believe, I overdid my crutches. Like, I was trying to walk as far as I could each time. And, you know, I was hurting myself. And, you know, I eventually got to the point where I really enjoyed and saw how thankful I was to finally just to walk, because I hadn't been able to. And the few months leading up to the surgery, I spent most of my time in severe pain on my back, and probably the worst pain I'd ever felt in my life. And so I started to, you know, we always talk about, you know, in for us, mental illness recovery and stabilizing, it's probably similar, just having a toolkit of resources for yourself that you can rely on. And if one's not working for you on that particular day, maybe you have something else. And so for me, it got more and more into, I really just enjoyed walking. I enjoyed just listening to my music and just being out in the sunshine. And that became, and my eyes started to open up a little bit more of what I was experiencing and how fulfilling that was to me. Man. The other thing was just really using what I had already been kind of doing on a smaller scale, but to talk more about my own personal struggles and how that can benefit somebody else, you know, sort of a different style of coaching. So just transparency, reaching out, get messages, just talking peer to peer, and then lifting got worked into there, but it was, what can I do? Well, training my arms is, you know, I'm a power lifter. What do I care? But I would do some of the stuff that I could. And then I was like, well, you know, I wanted, you know, lighter weight. So worked on my diet more, trying to stay a little bit leaner and some different things. But everything really became more of what, you know, this huge pie chart that was all about my lifting became more of just a part of, to where I actually enjoyed the idea of not worrying, oh my gosh, I got to get my workout now. I've got to have this time. What you were talking about, Dave, with like the food and stuff, you know, I just went on intermittent fasting really strictly. And I was like, if I eat two meals later on today and see how that works and how I feel. But it was really more of lifting to fit my recovery mentally for myself and how I was engaging with people in my life, how my home life was doing, you know, those different things. I wanted to focus more on what I'd said before. I'd ignored so much, and partly because I just didn't know and was misdiagnosed for years of things that were going on with me. I just wanted to be just mentally fit.
Yeah.
And lifting could be a part of that, but it couldn't be all of that or even half that. And then as I got better with my hip, I found like, oh, cool, deadlifting is kind of fun. I've always hated that and sucked at it, but kind of relearned my technique. So that's fun. I can kind of compete with that. That's cool. And be around that environment and be a cheerleader for everybody. So it really just put some different things into perspective on how lifting was going to fit in for the goal of my mental illness and supporting that recovery and being as stable seems to be like, well, duh, but not if you're from my world. Stable is something that you can be a struggle from day to day and sometimes hour to hour, depending on what's going on. So it really just became more about that. As much as I still love lifting and I love coaching people, and you know, one of my clients I used to work with, Dane Dillon, I was like, dude, you've outgrown me. Go do your thing. You know, and he's got his own stuff he's doing and he's up in Canada and I'm, you know, but I still have these relationships and all of that. So it just really, it started with a walk, and that opened up my eyes of how fulfilling that was. I wasn't bleeding out my nose with 800 pounds squatting or anything like that. It was a walk and listening to iTunes.
You were open-minded. You were being open-minded and you were being willing to look at what some other opportunities were, you know.
That's difficult. That's very difficult to do.
Yeah.
But I was at a primed point to where it was just there.
Yeah.
Not being in the hospital with great support system, and it just, I was very blessed in how it just kind of came together.
Mine was a little bit different in one sense, in that I'd always had when I started with the UC projects, obviously this was a ridiculous idea to see how effing big I could get, beyond all expectation and, you know, to all extremes. But there was actually some sensible planning behind that, in that this was a vehicle in which I could launch coaching and drug awareness and drug support advice and harm reduction off the back of it. Because no one was going to listen to me harping on about, well, this is dangerous, if I didn't have the credentials in order to discuss it. So I had to sort of almost prove myself in a certain way. So the projects, though, were genuine projects of something that I really wanted to do. There was also that secondary issue there where this will give me a platform off which I can work the harm reduction. The problem was that when you get into that shit, you start to lose sight of where you are.
Sure.
So I started to disappear down some rabbit holes, particularly in the second film, sort of covers it. And if you watch it properly, you will see where I'm going. And I start to disappear down drug rabbit holes, and I start to disappear down obsessiveness about size and everything else at all costs, and lose sight of the fact that this was a promotional vehicle at the same time. I, similar to yourself, though in a different aspect, ended up injured. In my case, it was kidney failure.
Oh, wow.
And then heart failure. Shit happens. The heart failure more came because of poor mismanagement of how I downgraded my training than anything else. I could have actually avoided that. It would have been a bit more sensible. But I was very suddenly and very quickly delivered an ultimatum by my health that this stops and it stops now. Otherwise, you don't live. This is where we're at. You know, if you carry on, you will die. But at the same time, mentally, I'd got to the point where I was done. I was broken. I was physically broken. I was mentally exhausted. the training, the eating, the drugs had all taken a massive toll. But, and even now, you know, I mean, we're 4 years on, and even now, I look at people doing well in the gym, I look at people growing, and I still get a little bit of a twinge of jealousy, and I'm not ashamed to admit it, you know, and just thinking, fucking hell, if I'd have stopped at one, I'd still be a decent size, still be fit, still be training, but I'd also maybe dead, because I wouldn't have gone as far as I'd gone, and probably had to keep pushing and pushing and pushing a different way. But
sure.
So I always had an escape route, but I didn't lose sight of that. I lost the door, so to speak. I lost where the fire exit was for a while. And it took me quite a while to find that. And then when I did find it, I found that walking out of that was actually incredibly difficult.
Yeah.
And I've sort of, I'm probably nowhere near as extreme as you are, Sean, but I do sort of have that little bit of a all or nothing with things.
A little bit, Dave? Just a little?
Just a little bit. And what I've done is I've thrown that now into my work, but to a degree, that's not left any room for the training. But it's easy to walk away from the training because the training feels so less than what it used to be. My love of training came from intensity of training. My love of training came from being able to train insanely hard. Ridiculously, way beyond what was probably necessary, but that was my big enjoyment, was that sadomasochistic sort of side of hurting yourself. And that's no longer, I can't deliver it to that level. So I find it, I have to think, no, you've got to go to the gym because you've got to keep your health up. You've got to keep fit. But at the same time, I've just replaced, I suppose, replaced the obsessiveness with training with the obsessiveness with work. So it's not unusual for me to work 12, 14 hours a day.
It's tough to find that balance, you know, even getting into recovery. I found, you know, you can still, well, I found in bodybuilding, you know, I might not be using drugs, but you can abuse anything else just as easily and be just as unhappy. And I think it's the, for me, and I think people that, you know, in recovery, I can't speak for everyone, but it's, I've found for myself, a lot of it is looking for something outside of myself to make me happy versus looking for that happiness from within, you know?
I can relate to that massively. I wasn't happy. And I think you then strive to find that happiness, you know, you look for happiness in achievements.
Yeah.
Rather than happiness in being content with who you are. And this, to me, boils down to being honest. You have to be honest with yourself. And there's a big difference between being honest with yourself and being critical. You have borderline personality disorder. That isn't a negative or a positive, it's just what you have. You can choose that to be a negative or positive. You used it in a positive way, which is why your wall is so decorated, and mine and Scott's aren't. but you can, it could, it's also been a negative factor at points in your life. It can be both. And I think the problem is when people try and self-review, they always look at themselves critically, and a part of that problem is because we're so exposed with social media, we have these very unreal benchmarks that actually don't exist. Now, you see people posting a happy life and new car, and I won't say a name because he's a really nice guy actually, but there's a lad I know on social media, it's a bit of a friend as well, done quite well successfully financially, does show his success, but not in a boasty way. He's not that sort of character. He does it more in a just, you know, enjoying life and celebrating things way, not in a, oh, look at me, I'm so amazing way. And he recently did something that was very, very generous and helped somebody out financially in a big way. And it was a complete random stranger, not somebody he knew, through his business. And then a week later, He sort of came through about how depressed he was and how empty his life was and how miserable he was. And the reason he'd been so generous was to try and create some self-worth.
Sure.
So his actual generosity was actually quite a selfish act, because he didn't do it to benefit the other people so much. He did it more to benefit himself by improving his self-loathing. And to pretty much 99% of the people that will interact with this guy, they think he had the perfect life. And that's one of the problems we have, is we constantly compare ourselves to those around us instead of just looking at us and going, right, prime example, I'm fat. No denying it, I'm fat. But I'm not fat enough for me to do enough to change it dramatically. Am I capable of doing it? Yes. Do I want to do it? Yeah, sort of. And that's where you've got to look at yourself and go, right, well, I'm not happy with this. This is what it takes to change that. Is the cost of that change worth the perceived happiness of that change? And if it's not, you're just not going to change. So why stress about it? Move on to things that you can change. Move on to things that you are willing to change, and take control of your life that way. Instead of constantly looking at everybody around you and going, well, he's better than me because he's this, or he's better than me because he's that.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. You know, we're getting closer to the end of the hour here. So I want to ask Sean, you know, what are some things that listeners, viewers can do if they do need help? You know, I know that, you know, you found, you recognized you needed help. I know that you are involved with a hotline. Am I correct?
Yeah. I always just put the number out there, but we're pretty lucky here in Utah. They've got some great mental health resources through UNI, which is University of Utah, a place that I was resident at.
Right on.
Great food. they have Safe Utah, which is an app that you can download. And, you know, for us in the area, that's great because you can actually make a report or submit a tip for a mental health kind of crisis.
Oh.
But there is, which is changing. So the talk hotline that everybody's familiar with, the suicide prevention hotline, has been 800-273-TALK. And now they are looking at changing that for legislation to make it 988. When that goes into effect, I'm not sure. They actually haven't given a timeline, the last that I knew. But that'll be there. There's also the crisis text line, which is 741-741. And you can actually text and go from there. And I know on Twitter, they actually have, for the UK, some different resources similarly that you can find them as well. So I don't have those handy, but those are a couple of great ones that you go for. And I think it's great, too, because there are warm lines. So it doesn't mean you have to necessarily be in crisis, but you just want to talk.
Hmm.
You just want to talk with somebody. And just having a bad day, want some perspective from a stranger. You don't want necessarily maybe anybody to know it, because maybe you feel a little weird. You don't want people knowing, you know, the whole stigma, right? So this gives people an option to engage and to talk with that. So, and with NAMI, again, they also have some chat lines that you can jump onto, and peer support groups. So you talk with somebody else that has struggles, share some experiences, pull from it what you want, encourage somebody else with your own experiences. I think there's a lot of power in peer support. When I was a school teacher, peer educating was one of my favorite ways of kids learning and supporting each other. And as an adult, I see it just as valuable.
Hmm. Right on. Is there anything we aren't talking about here? Is there anything that we haven't mentioned, any topics here that we should discuss before we go?
The only area I would say, which is probably the most contextual area of it all, is the overdiagnosis. It's probably the closest I'm going to get to the correct term. There seems to be a growing trend that it's almost popular to have or to claim mental health disorders. Okay. And this is going to sound harsh, but there is a percentage of people out there that just need to pull the finger out of their asses and stop being fucking drips. But at the same time, the problem with this is this takes away from those that are genuinely suffering.
Mm, yeah.
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 Now, we have the same problem with ADHD over here. I don't know if it's the same in the States, where ADHD got over-diagnosed. And as a result, genuine sufferers with ADHD were just put down to being badly behaved kids with poor parenting. because so badly behaved kids had used ADHD as an excuse.
Yeah.
And there is a danger of that as well. It is perfectly normal to get pissed off. It is perfectly normal to feel frustrated. It is perfectly normal to have really shitty days. We are not supposed to feel good all the time.
This is true.
If it rained every day, you would never appreciate the rain. And if it was sunshine every day, you would never appreciate the sunshine.
Yeah.
We have and should have ups and downs. That's what creates balance in life. And that's what keeps us appreciating the good times and respecting the bad times, the lessons that they are. Just because you feel shit does not mean you have mental health. But if you constantly feel shit, then you need to start asking some questions. And it worries me that at the same time that we need to be more aware and that we need to offer more support, that there will be those that take advantage of that situation because they just don't want to put in the graft that life takes. And life is hard. Life isn't easy. You know, it is difficult, it is challenging, it is rewarding, but it's hard as well. And if you think that life is going to get you somewhere without struggle, then you're sorely mistaken. You're living in a fucking dream world. Because I don't know anyone that's made success that hasn't had dark times in getting there.
Yeah. Anything you want to add to that, Sean?
I love that you brought that up. And particularly because we're on the same mindset with that. That seems to be our biggest struggle, especially, you know, volunteering and talking with people in groups. It is distinguishing the two different things. Here in the States, we'll talk about mental illness and mental health. You know, and again, we try to make those distinctions so people understand, hey, guess what? You're going to have bad days. Those will happen. You know, you're going to be you have those ups and downs. And the problem, again, as I sort of hinted, I get so frustrated when different groups pander towards a celebrity that talks about being sad, and then they run with it, and they make them the poster child for mental illness. Yeah. And that may be accurate, or it could be a conversation that is created with no real depth and substance to it, that really all it does is marginalize what somebody with clinical depression goes through.
Mm-hmm.
And those are so different.
Yeah.
Or somebody that is, you know, struggles with bipolar disorder and what they go through. So yes, I thank you for bringing that up, because the marginalizing of a group that really society for the most part would like to ignore and just say, just get over it, it's in your head. More like, yeah, no shit. It's a little bit more complicated than that, but yeah, it is in our head. And that is unfortunately why it gets marginalized, because we can't see it. You see somebody on crutches or in a wheelchair, you know, somebody with an amputee, you've got a little more appreciation. We can see that tangible effect of it.
Yeah.
Somebody like me, they look at me and just think, well, you're just a fucking train wreck.
Mm.
Yeah. Sorry, am I allowed to swear? I
yep,
guess I
yeah. Yes. Whatever. Yes.
I'd be fucked if we weren't.
Okay. So looking back at that, yeah, some choices that I made were certainly within my control.
Yeah.
And some of them, I did not have the tools. I was not equipped. And I was a Tasmanian devil set loose. And I look back and such remorse and shame. And I feel like, I think people for like my last 20 years, I should find them all and just apologize just in case.
All of them, huh?
You know, well, a lot for sure. And I look at that. So yeah, definitely the marginalizing of a population of people that actually have legitimate struggles. And then for the other thing is to let people know life is hard for everybody. It is hard. And if you're trying to make your persona through social media, just stop. You know, use it for what you need to. Preface it that this is just a segment of my life, not all of it. You know, we'd be so much better served if social media, unfortunately, we wouldn't have these wonderful outlets. But if social media was narrowed down a little bit more, because it can be so destructive. For somebody like me, I struggle a lot, and I have to take breaks from it because it gets overwhelming for me. But yeah, you know, definitely, Dave, you hit the nail on the head. We need to recognize people need to toughen up. you know, as much as people all think now that I just want to hug everybody and love it all away, I mean, sort of, but at the same time, like, it, you need to, I still believe in blood, sweat, and chalk, you know? Life's hard, and you got to fight.
No, you ahead, look Dave. Like you'd be a nice hug.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah, I think you'd be a nice hug, yeah.
Too much hip, but, you know.
No, not much bum touching, but I think it'd be a nice hug.
Just lower back. Caress the lower back.
Have you ever had a conversation with Mike Quinn?
No.
You, that would be an interesting person to speak to.
Uh-oh.
He has severe ADHD. Severe.
Okay.
Wasn't diagnosed till about 2 years ago.
Oh, wow.
So spent most of his competitive career banging shitloads of gear down his throat with severe ADHD.
Wow.
Yes, you can imagine the sort of shit he used to get up to.
Yes. That's scary.
Yeah, I've heard stories.
Mike's a scary character. I like Mike. I've got a lot of time for Mike, but he's definitely different.
All right.
He's wired his own unique way. From someone who's lived through all the same sort of stuff, and yeah, he's actually a good person to speak to with that sort of stuff.
All right, very cool. Well, we appreciate your time, Sean. Man, this is very good.
Thank you. Very good
stuff, and yeah, I hope that if there's somebody out there that is listening to this that can, you know, relate to this, that is resonating with it, that hasn't asked for the help that they need, I hope that this might be the catalyst that might push them forward just a little bit closer to that. So thank you very much.
Awesome. Thank you.
For another episode of Drugs and Stuff with Dave Crossland and special guest Sean Bellin. Thank you guys very much for listening. We'll see you soon.